more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. One of the key people responsible for the rise of Milwaukee's fine dining scene over the past three decades is chef and Milwaukee native Sanford D'Amato. The James Beard Award-winning chef founded and owned Sanford Restaurant for 23 years, was the first American chef to break into the French-controlled kitchens of New York in the 1970s, and he just released his memoir with recipes called Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer. Ahead of his appearances this week at Coquette Cafe, Chef D'Amato stopped by to chat with Bonnie North, and he said that food has always been part of his life.
My mother was an amazing cook, and then my grandfather was too. It was kind of funny with my grandfather because he was not the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book,
right? But when he was working with food, there was this like dreamy smile that you just never saw that would come over his face. That was the only time. It seemed like it was the only time he was really, really happy. And he had said he really wanted to be a chef. And he had never, you know, he had just never had that chance to do that. He became, you know, became a grocer. And it was funny because he died before I got out of cooking school. I was cooking at the time, which he was really happy about. And,
but he never got to see what you achieved, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, well, it is. But The good part of it, I think, that he would really enjoy is the dishes that he did over the years that I incorporated into our food, both just making it at home but at Sanford too.
So how did growing up in Milwaukee at the time that you did, in this family that you did, affect the chef that you are now? I mean, what is it about this Milwaukee experience?
Well, I mean, everything that I've done over my life has been done here. You know, I mean, from the first time I cooked to my first kiss, my first, you know, everything was in this city. And at the time that I was getting into cooking, my father, he talked to the Pabst salesman. He had the grocery store, and that's actually where Sanford Restaurant came from. It was my grandfather's and father's grocery store over on Jackson and Pleasant. He told me about a place called Kultz, which was an older German restaurant over on Oakland and Locust. And that's kind of where I started. They're doing Friday night fish fries, which every good Milwaukee cook or chef should know how to do, breading onion rings. And after I was working at Kultz for a while, I wanted to get into some kind of a program. And back in the late 60s, there really weren't a lot of programs to get into. And I found out about one from the Jewish Vocational Services. The best part of it was that it was free. And so it was at a downtown building in Milwaukee, right on Wisconsin Avenue. So I went down there about 6 o'clock, and of course all the buildings at that time were pretty much deserted at 6 o'clock, and it was a kind of a creepy feeling going up the elevator and getting in. But there was this class, and just in one of the offices up there, it was run by a chef from Strucel's at that time, which was like a prime rib place over on the west side. It was Tom Radcliffe. And he had a group there, and I was the youngest by probably 15 to 20 years.
That was, and so how old were you at this point?
I was 19.
Okay.
18, 19, right around that. Anyway, he was teaching, and he was a great teacher. But during the class, it seemed like none of the students were really that interested in the class. And I was expecting this kind of, you know, camaraderie of talking to all the students, and afterwards we'd talk cooking or go get some coffee somewhere, or I couldn't drink at that time. But this never happened. So after about 3 months, Chef Radcliffe called me into his office after class. He asked me if I could stay, and I did, and I didn't know if that was like a good or bad thing. But he's talking to me afterwards. He said, you know, he says, "You're really interested in cooking, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, isn't everyone here? I mean, that's why we're here, to learn to be chefs." And he said, "Oh," he says, "you don't know, do you?" And I said, "No, what?" And he said, "You're the only one here that doesn't have to be here. Everyone else is on work release from prison." So that was my first cooking school experience. So he's the one who told me about different options and told me about the Culinary Institute. And that's how I ended up going out there when they first moved from Yale's, they were on Yale's campus in New Haven, to Hyde Park.
And then, of course, you're in New York, and you're the first American to kind of break into that very French world at the time of fine dining cuisine. I imagine that, you know, the techniques that you learned and the way to run a kitchen were things that you still use today. How much of that is incorporated into the cuisine that eventually became your signature?
Oh, it's all part of it. You know, every chef has a cooking signature of what they do. And it comes from their technique that they learn. And that's what I learned from, you know, working for the French chefs in New York, and what I learned for working for my other mentor, Peter Van Erp, who was a Dutch chef who I worked with at the Culinary Institute. And then they have their palate, which can range from any part of the palate. It can be some chefs go to the acid side, some chefs go to the sweet side, some are bitter. But it's all that incorporation that if you give one dish to five different chefs, you're going to get five different dishes. And if you know those chefs, if you know their food, you're going to know whose dish is whose just by the taste of that dish, because every dish becomes kind of a template of their journey, of where they've been and sometimes where they're going. And then the other part of your signature is your taste memories. And that's, I think, is the most important part. And it's really what makes distinctive food, because my taste memories are completely different from yours. So when you're looking at a dish, if people would incorporate that into their food, everybody would have really, really distinctive, delicious food. Everybody doesn't do that. I mean, now it's become almost kind of chic to go on and find what the new hot dish is and just take a recipe off the internet and make it. But what that becomes a recipe, and I tell everybody that works for me over the years, I mean, recipes are, they're really soulless frames without knowing where the food came from. And that's really what the book is about, is the stories, because without the stories, there is no food. There are no recipes.
And you incorporate all of these wonderful recipes. And I think about you say, of course, my taste memories are different from yours. But it seems that what you're offering here is a way for me to kind of get close to your taste memories.
Yes. Well, because, I mean, having said that with, you know, that recipes are soulless frames, I mean, I better figure out a way in the book to put some soul into them so that people buying the book and making the recipes have an idea of what I'm thinking of when I'm making it and the technique that I put into it. So that's what I feel the story does. But it gives every reader the freedom to take that recipe and put themselves into it, which is going to probably make it different from what I would do, but possibly better.
And one of the things that really struck me that you said in one of the first little stories in the book of never forgetting that part of your job is to make the people eating your food as happy mm-hmm. as you are when you are making the food. And do you think that's something that we're missing a lot of times, that chefs forget that part of the job is to make people eating their food happy?
Well, it's very easy to get isolated in a kitchen and to not realize that there's someone eating your food. This isn't an ego trip. I mean, this is about comfort, and this is about making people happy. And as a chef, it's really important to understand that. And what I try to do at the restaurant, what we tried to do over the years at the restaurant, was to have everyone that worked in the kitchen and everyone that worked in the dining room too come in for dinner and to sit down and to actually be a customer and to see the food from a different perspective, that you realize that after a night of doing 100 people, when you're putting out that last dish, that person doesn't care that you've just put out 55 dishes. It's that person being there for the first time. It's kind of like to use a baseball analogy of, I mean, a great hitter. I mean, Ted Williams, one of the great hitters of all time, batted 405. I mean, if I batted 405 cooking, I'd be out of a job. I mean, you got to, I mean, 9 for 10 doesn't, 900 doesn't make it. You've got to, every dish has to be perfect when it goes out for a customer, because a customer doesn't care that 9 other people got a great dish and they got a lousy one.
As you were choosing the recipes here, how did you pick them? How did you go through? Because I imagine there are many favorites that you have and things that bring back stories and memories for you that you would have liked to have included but didn't have room for.
Well, it was because of the stories. The stories brought about the recipes that are in the book. The last 10 recipes, because people always say, what are your favorite recipes? And so I compiled those in the last 10 recipes in the book. Those are my desert island recipes that I would have to eat for the rest of my life. You know, my the spadini Sicilian spadini, the cookies, having the pecan and brown sugar cookies, and those are all my favorite. Those are my favorite things. But all the other recipes have, from the chicken pastina soup in the beginning to my variation on my mother's cinnamon ribs. It runs the gamut of simple to the ginger snap cannoli that did for Julia Child's 80th birthday. And that was really the transition dish when we opened Sanford between the grocery store and the restaurant.
Well, now that Sanford has a new owner and you are moving on to other things, you've got the book, you're still cooking, of course. As you look back at sort of the trajectory of Milwaukee's fine dining, we're getting recognition, but I'm curious where you think we're going.
Well, what's happening, and it isn't unique to Milwaukee. It's unique to the whole country right now, is when I moved back to Milwaukee in 1980 and I left New York, it was a big decision because I was leaving the epicenter of food in the world. And I was a pretty competitive guy, but I was looking for balance in my life. And I wanted to come back here for two reasons. One of them was for that balance, for relationships and to have a normal life. And the other one was I wanted to open up a restaurant. And I knew in New York I could open a restaurant, but I'd never own the restaurant because I'd never have that kind of money. What has happened since that time is that the rest of the country, the coasts, the media coasts, discovered that there was something in between and that there was great food all around the country. And it made it possible for chefs to move back to wherever they were from and to be able to do that and to be able to do the food that they want to do and to be able to survive. And that's what's happening in the city right now. There's not only chefs that are from here that have gone away and then come back, but there's other chefs that are just moving here that realize that this is a great, it's a great way to live. It's a great lifestyle, but they can do the kind of food that they want to do and that they can survive and that people are going to support them.
So is there a signature Milwaukee style for somebody who's looking from the outside in?
I think people incorporating parts of the Midwest into their food, but it depends on their background too. Justin, who took over Sanford. I mean, he's bringing his Armenian background into the food, but he's also using all the products of the state. It's really kind of funny talking about farm to table now that it is, it is a signature byword of restaurants. I mean, that's the way food always was. It was always farm to table when it started out, because the only place that you could get product before it was shipped was you had to go to the farmer's market. And that's what restaurants ran on. I mean, and it was only in the 70s when flying fish started that they actually started flying food around the country, where you could get things from outside of the country even brought in. And that's 40, 50 years ago, but it's still very recent. I mean, in the 70s, cooking in New York, we had asparagus in spring. We only had salmon, fresh salmon in spring. There was no other time of the year where there was fresh salmon around. And a lot of chefs are doing this now, but they're cooking that way. Even though you can get strawberries all year around, you want to get strawberries in that end of May, beginning June when they're the best and when they're local, when they're so fragile that they can't be shipped. People are starting to get it.
So what's next for you?
Well, for us, we have a place out in Hatfield, Massachusetts. It's right in between Northampton and Amherst, right on the Connecticut River. We're going to have a small cooking school, hands-on, 10 to 12 people at a time in our home. So we're building that right now. And then we've already planted, starting 4 years ago, planting the whole that area of the little under the 2 acres. And so we'll be able to go out and get asparagus or rhubarb, or we have 16 fruit trees that we planted. So it's all starting to come around right now. So the classes will be run around what is fresh at that time.
So training the next generation.
Exactly. And that's what you should do. One other baseball analogy, you peak, sometimes when you're, in your 30s, and then you become the wily veteran. If you're still pitching when you're 40s, you're usually a freak of nature. But after that, you get into coaching and you get into managing and you get into teaching. I'm not going to stop cooking. That's my life. But I'll just be able to pass it on.
Well, Sandy D'Amato, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me here.
Award-winning chef and restaurateur Sanford D'Amato was born and brought up in Milwaukee. He calls his new book a memoir with recipes. The full title is Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer, and it's published by Agate Midway Publishing in Chicago. D'Amato will talk about his book and sign copies tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday at Coquette Cafe in the Third Ward. He spoke with Bonnie North. A last break, and then we'll preview the Milwaukee Reps production of the classic farce Noises Off when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.